every great company starts the same way, with a dream. Not a pitch deck, not a spreadsheet, but a vision. And behind every entrepreneur is the same starting point. A belief that something better is possible and the willingness to take on the risk of trying to build it. Welcome to Dreaming Big. I'm Alexis Allen, and I'm a relationship manager on the Texera Locker Group at UBS. I've spent the last decade working alongside founders across industries and stages. From ideas scribbled on napkins to companies scaling faster than anyone expected, I have seen what it really takes to turn vision into reality. What has always drawn me is not just the outcome. It is the optimism, the grit, and the ability to hold a vision long before anyone else believes in it. On Dreaming Big, I sit down with entrepreneurs to talk about where that dream started, the moments that shaped them, the pivots they did not plan, what they're building, who they're becoming, and the lives they're trying to live along the way. And so we go deep into identity, turning points, joy, and the seasons where that dream felt fragile but somehow survived. This isn't just a podcast about startups. It's about making something out of nothing, about protecting an idea long enough for it to become real, and about the courage to keep going day after day. And so whether you're building your first company, scaling your fifth, investing in a founder, or simply drawn to people who see the future before it exists, this is for you. This is Dreaming Big. And so let's dive in. Today, I'm talking with Angeline, co-founder of Cherub. Angeline is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services and her views are her own. This conversation is one I've been looking forward to for a while because Angeline's vision is solving a problem that most founders and investors have experienced. Here's the thing, founders and angel investors are constantly missing each other. Founders are asking, where are all of the angels? And angels are asking, where are all of the good ideas? They're both searching in the dark, and the current platforms out there weren't built for people just getting started. They're built for the already connected and already experienced. And so Angeline and her co-founder Jacqueline Johnson had an idea on a hike, which was what if connecting founders with angel investors could work more like dating apps? What if instead of cold emails and awkward networking events, you could match based on a strategic fit, on shared values, and on what both sides actually need from each other? So they built Cherub. Cherub is a platform that already has helped deploy over $1 million to founders, with 40% of those checks being written by first or second time angel investors. That is the kind of democratization that changes the game. And what I love about Angeline's story is that she's not new to building and scaling. She spent nearly 5 years at Opendoor, and before that, she was part of the founding team at Open Listings, which was a Y Combinator company that scaled to $4 billion in transactions before being acquired by Opendoor. She knows what it takes to build marketplaces, and she knows what it takes to scale. But with Cherub, she's not just building a product. She's building access. She's building opportunity. She's reimagining how capital flows to the people who need it most. So let's dive in. Well, Angeline, thank you so much for joining. I'm so excited to chat with you about all about your background, all things Cherub, and I'm just grateful that you're taking the time to spend with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So before we hop into things, what I really want to do is just understand a little bit about you as a person before we talk about all of your professional accolades. Tell me a little bit about if there is something important for me to know about you. So this could be anything from how you were raised, an early experience that shaped you, but just something that helped create the foundation for who you are today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I would be who I am without the fact that my parents are actually both Vietnam War refugees. And so their immigrant story is like the cornerstone of what defines me. It's actually pretty wild. Very long story short, they both came over after the Vietnam War. My father actually was imprisoned in North Vietnamese, like a re-education camp, escaped that, was imprisoned again, and then finally escaped. He actually lost his first wife and his first daughter. I have a half brother. There's just been like so much heaviness kind of that experience. My mother came over pretty early in the war, and they both ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. They're getting married, raising little Angeline in this like very interesting environment. And so I'd say like there wasn't a day of my early childhood where I didn't know kind of what preceded me. And I think as I grew up, I never grew up without the sense of gratitude. It wasn't like, oh, look how much worse it could be. It really was your parents did a lot and sacrificed a lot to get you to where you are today. And so I carry that with me.
I mean, what incredible perspective. And thank you for sharing that, because that really is an extraordinary foundation to build a family's life upon, and probably learned a ton of lessons and skills in terms of resilience and real vision building from your parents to see a future here in America, and also just hold that legacy to pass down to their children. So that is an extraordinary thing to know about you. And I actually didn't know that about you. So
yeah, I know. I don't really talk about it a lot. I think related to that too, my mom was like a psychology major and then became an accountant over here. And my dad was a lawyer and became a pastry chef. And I think part of that is they taught me not just resilience, but kind of working with what you have, right? So both of those are careers that you can build without having the best English skills to start off. And so really, it was interesting because it's about taking the circumstances in which you're given and kind of allowing to be like to reinvent who you are.
That's beautiful. And I'm sure they are extraordinarily proud of everything that you've done. What's amazing is, you know, when I think about your career, you've almost had a little bit of like the two chapter experience from what I can tell, where it's, you know, started in music and has expanded into tech. And so I would love for you to just share a little bit more about kind of your early career, or even just like coming out of school and what that looked like. And then, you know, a little bit about how you've used some of those learnings into what you have done later in your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I started my career off in the music industry. I think why it was just music has always been a big passion of mine. I was never a great musician. I never felt like making music was my calling, but I always felt energized and obsessed with creativity and kind of outside thinking and how do I become a part of this? I think at, you know, the age of 10 or 11, I realized you didn't have to be a musician in order to be like plugged into this, could work in the industry. You could be a photographer or a journalist. And so, you know, this is the late 90s, early aughts. And I was able to finagle my way as like a 10th grader into writing for an online magazine. Fast forward, it's 2007. I was pretty plugged in at the time in the music scene. I had just gotten a job graduating college with a music producer and songwriter located in Malibu. Moved from Atlanta to Malibu. Started to realize like this is on the heels of the 2008 global financial crisis, in a world where like streaming services and illegal downloading are starting to eat away at the market share. It was inevitable that you were kind of on the sinking ship. And I could kind of see that and feel the shift of that happening at the same time. And so as this was happening, I thought about the core of what I really love to do and kind of where my unique capabilities were. And as I mentioned, it was in things like building newsletters, using kind of these tools to create content, to build community and share. At the time, I had seen a job posting for a community manager. And imagine, like, it's 2008. This idea of a community manager, like, I know it sounds insane, but I'm pretty sure I had one of the very first, like, community manager jobs out there. I was able to basically get their attention because one of the bands that I had been on tour with taking content for was actually running a marketing campaign through that startup's website. Mm-hmm. And so I got the lead singer of that band to do a testimonial video for me. I uploaded that as a part of my application for the job, got the job, and really that like changed my trajectory. So it was really like now all of a sudden I have this career in social media. Social media is super like new and hot, and all the brands are hiring people to come on board, kind of teach and train. Imagine like prompt engineering like 2 years ago, right? Like teaching other people how to use these really powerful tools. Parlayed that into, you know, what I think in hindsight is the real cornerstone turning point for my career, which was a job at a digital agency at the time called Huge. And then from there, the rest is history for me in terms of my own professional development. It's where I met one of my good friends who ended up convincing me to join his startup that had just come out of Y Combinator. And then from there, a year and a half later, we got acquired by another company. And then a year and a half after that, that company went public. And so kind of went through this wild, you know, maybe once, hopefully twice career style journey that got me to where I am today, which is, you know, running my own startup and more in the product management side of things.
It is such a cool career journey because you started out with an area that you were deeply passionate about, but really kind of followed where the market was indicating there was a need for. And like, you know, building the plane while flying was a little bit of your career where you yeah. learned a lot of the skills that ended up becoming super useful later. It's funny hearing a little bit about kind of your story because all this stuff was new then and now is, you know, a lot of people's dream job. But you were one of the first people to, whether it was community or social media or, you know, again, in the world of, you know, joining Y Combinator startups, that was probably one of the first types of cohorts that you had joined. And yet now it's obviously very well known. And so to even have the inclination to join in, you know, a great startup that ultimately gets acquired and then ultimately that company goes public is just so, so cool and a unique experience. Can you share a little bit about kind of that going public experience from an employee perspective? Because I think we hear a lot about from, you know, a founder perspective there, that's the dream, you know, to go public. But tell me a little bit about what that was like, just being at an early stage company, first getting acquired. That's a huge deal, being at a startup that gets acquired and then getting to see a company go public. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, happy to chat through that. So I think what was really, I would say, even more special and unique is it wasn't like, oh, I'm just going to go, you know, join an early stage startup. That was never my intention and my goal. In fact, at the time, I was consulting and freelancing for that agency, I mentioned Huge. So I really enjoyed that experience. And then my good friend, Judd, who I had worked with, but he was the co-founder and CEO of a real estate startup called Open Listings. They had just come out of Y Combinator and had just fundraised. And he basically was like, come work for me. Come like lead our growth and marketing. And I was like, Judd, I've never done marketing. I was like, I kind of don't know half of what you're asking me to do here. I've never like run a paid marketing budget. I don't understand. My background is like user experience, product strategy at this point. And he was like, I know, that's why I think you'd be really good at it. You kind of are the right person because you don't speak this language. It's not going to be too salesy. You're going to take like a user first approach to this problem. And so I joined. I think I was the first non-technical, non-like licensed real estate person to join, which was pretty incredible. We were a home buying and selling experience. Think like a Redfin competitor. Within a year, we had gotten to $4 billion in GMV, like of transactions, which was pretty wild. And at that point, we were at the point where I think we were going to raise a Series B. And we had this inflection moment of either we raise or we take this offer. So at the time, the CEO and one of the co-founders had reached out to Judd just on a whim and was like, hey, do you want to talk? And ultimately, it felt like the right decision at the time, just because, you know, we knew that joining forces with them would really allow us to build the product that we thought needed to exist out there, which was just a seamless, more affordable home buying and selling experience. It's the largest purchase that most people make in their lives and the largest transaction. And so there's just a lot of inefficiency in that process. So, you know, we were just super excited to join a team that was doing some really, really cool, innovative, never heard of things. So we joined that team and then a few months go by and Judd tells me, he's like, We're going public. And it's kind of wild. And it was just such a weird moment because it was hard to wrap my head around. Like, I don't think I understood really what that meant. Of course, there's equity tied to when you join a startup, but I never anticipated, and I don't recommend joining a startup thinking that that equity will result or amount to anything. So I did not anticipate that I would have my own liquidity event and that it would be like decent. And, you know, that's part of why I ended up starting Cherub. And then it was really fast. I think once it was announced, we had an interesting road to IPO. We were part of a SPAC. one of the Chamath SPACs. I think we were IPOB, the second one he brought public. And then we had a 90-day lockup period. So there was that weird time. Like, oh, there's this really interesting life-changing number on paper, but there's nothing I can do with that. And who knows what it's going to be at the moment in which I can do something with that money. And so that was just a wild ride.
I think a lot of people do join startups with kind of that dream in mind, whether they start them or they join them. And so to be able to experience that, especially in kind of the time frame that you did, is really cool. And again, it was in a way that I think a lot of people will always think about, you know, whether it was the pandemic or whether it was, you know, going public through a SPAC. Those will forever be conversations that people will be so interested in, that experience, just being a part of that. And that excitement, but also the stress of, you know, how long do you ride that wave for? Or like, how much do you stay in versus, you know, come out? Because you not only had, you know, this experience working for these startups, but you also were doing consulting and freelancing. And so for you, you've had this like amazing experience being able to pattern match what makes great founders, what makes great companies. And so it naturally lent itself probably well to being a great advisor, but also maybe a great investor. And you've gotten to invest in some amazing companies like Ceremonia and Bloomy and Isle of Monday. And so I would love to just, one, hear a little bit about kind of how you started dipping your toe into the world of angel investing and kind of what prompted that. And two, you know, when you first started doing it, how did you, you know, start finding great companies and founders? And what was kind of your initial thesis? And what were the things that you were looking for both in companies and founders?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'd say the reason why, or how I got started angel investing, was really through my co-founder, Jacqueline. So I think our founder story and how I get started angel investing are very much intertwined. Maybe for context, my co-founder of Cherub, Jacqueline Johnson, has had an incredible, prolific career building communities. She's a very successful businesswoman and entrepreneur, has had over 25 million in exits for herself. And I think on the angel investing side, her kind of claim to fame is her very first investment was in the friends and family round of Away Luggage. She wrote a $10,000 check, got a seven-figure exit from that, and has been kind of angel investing in companies ever since, has a portfolio of over 25 investments. I tell you all of this great stuff about her just so that you kind of have a little bit of context, but then also so that you know she's one of my very good friends. We actually were friends before we were business partners. And she had always invested in like mostly a lot of consumer, like CPG. And it was funny and eye-opening for me because I actually didn't even think about the idea that like a consumer CPG company could also be a startup, because I was so entrenched in the tech startup world. In fact, in a way where basically any of the tiny, you know, random angel investment opportunities that I was being given, they were basically all in prop tech. Oh, well, I'll send you, you know, I get a ton of deal flow. I'll just send you, you know, deals. That thing just, it just kind of stuck with me. I was like, I wonder how many me's there are out there. And so ultimately did some research on angel investing in the space and realized that 97% of accredited angel investors don't angel invest. And I was one of those people. And that's part of why we built Cherub, is we wondered, could we get more of these people off the sidelines deploying capital? And then also, you know, increasing their access to really great founders. So I think to your point around thesis, I want to be really clear. And, you know, you are in wealth management. So, and I know you're an angel investor. So I wonder, I'm very curious to hear your perspective on this. I don't angel invest for returns. Like, I think that obviously it is an unbelievably risky asset class. Every time I hear a positive story from one of my portfolio companies, I'm like, good for you. This makes me happy. I feel like we really might just pull this through into like a return here. But that is not why I angel invest. I wanted to be strategic about where I can provide my expertise to improve the likelihood of a return for me. That return could be financial. It could be social. It could be emotional. But I would put on the list, or like the stack ranking of how I expect to get returns. I put financial last, and I think about it really as social first. So I had never angel invested before Cherub. I now have 7 investments. 6 of them are on Cherub, and 1 of them is like a friends and family deal. So that's like, you know, in tech, we call this dog fooding. So very much dog fooded the product to become like, have seen, you know, at this point, like over 1,000 pitch decks. So I have a really good sense of what good looks like. And I think it's very much a cliche to say, but it's so true, is like, you're betting on founders, right? You're betting on people that you really feel have these unfair or, you know, distinct advantages to kind of take what they're building to the next level in the market and stand out from the competition. And so I think about it in one way of like, do I believe that this founder has what it takes to win in the space? Am I personally invested and interested in the space? Is their business model interesting? Like, I'm just a nerd. So I kind of like kind of thinking about how you go to market and how you make your money. And then from a strategic value perspective, can I go in beyond the tiny check that I write? So I don't, you know, I think another thing to be very obvious about is that I don't write big checks. I think the largest check I've written into a company is like 15K. I typically write checks anywhere from $2,500 to $5,000. And I'm very clear about that up front. And then as far as strategic value, like, can I help you kind of uniquely go from 0 to 1 or 1 to 100. So a lot of the founders will come to me, like, for example, there's one of my portcos is going through an accelerator right now, and they come to me for UX help, like vibe code stuff in Figma with them so that they can share with their engineer, like, because I know that's going to get them further than my $5,000 check is going to get them, or fundraising help, or figuring out how do I go from MVP or beta to the next level of scale in a way that I have kind of this unique perspective that I can offer.
There's so much about what you just shared that I so resonate with. And I think this is why we certainly initially connected. And it's both your thinking and kind of psychology around how you think about angel investing, which is a lot of people are really fascinated by it. And I think that the way that you just laid out why you angel invest really is super interesting. And I think the second piece, which I also relate to, is capital is one way to invest, but there's another way, which is, you know, how do you bring your incredible experience and background to help support them? And what I really appreciate about the tech ecosystem is that so many individuals who have benefited from working in that ecosystem and potentially, you know, profiting from that ecosystem, reinvest it. And that's both through capital as well as through experience and knowledge. And obviously you do both. What I would love to just hear a little bit more about is the dog food element, which you obviously have you're a customer of Cherub, but you also helped raise some of your own capital for Cherub through Cherub. Tell me a little bit about that experience. And again, you know, how you initially thought about fundraising and how you have evolved since then.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that to be very blunt, the reality versus expectation of fundraising was like, because we initially had come up with the idea for Cherub and we were like, let's just launch a landing page, a waitlist, just to like test, does anybody want this? So we built and launched a no-code MVP. We strung together a bunch of tools that cost, I would say, like less than $100 a month. And really the goal was like, can we get enough traction to kind of get us to a place where we could be raising from angels, or we could be raising on Cherub. We built Cherub mostly for what Jacqueline likes to call the quiet angels, which is someone like me, or, you know, I'll give you examples of other people on our cap table that we met through Cherub, an M&A lawyer, you know, who has given us really great legal advice, who doesn't bill us like our lawyer hourly rates. We have people who are PR professionals who are able to kind of guide us or introduce us to the right people to help, you know, lock down sponsorships or event venues and all of those things. So again, like we've really seen the value of the quiet angels providing strategic value. And so we've always built Cherub to be more than just a check-in, because if it was just a fund and done experience, we're actually not going to like get most startups the outcome they need, because individual angels, especially newer ones, you know, their sweet spot that we've seen is like somewhere closer to 10 to 25K checks. You know, if you're trying to raise a bridge round, even like a smaller round of 100, 250K, that's still not like the biggest dent. And so what we've seen is what we can bring to the table are people that can really help you build alongside you without like adding overhead. And so that's been the way that we have best utilized Cherub, and that we've seen other founders best utilizing Cherub as well.
It makes a lot of sense. And it's probably been a really amazing data source for you to better understand how people are using it, how people think about it, you know, the average check size, how they bring additional value outside of just their capital. And, you know, what you as a founder look for on your cap table may or may not be the same as what other founders who are utilizing Cherub may be thinking about. I feel like I've been following the journey for now like over a year. And so I feel like I've been following it for a little bit. But tell me a little bit, for those who, you know, don't know about Cherub, a little bit about the evolution, but really about like what you're building and why people should be interested in what you're developing.
Yeah. So ultimately, we launched Cherub with the hypothesis and kind of the desire to bring both, you know, really great startup founders, kind of industry agnostic, and strategic angel investors to the table. We saw a huge gap in the experience. I think I'm very familiar with this. You are, I don't know how many people are familiar with the stat, but it's something like less than 2% of VC funding goes to women and underrepresented founders. And while Cherub is not necessarily for that, you know, I think we built this for people who don't, who have limited amounts of rich uncles or no rich uncles, right? Like this idea of a friends and family round or knowing angel investors is not a given to a lot of people. And that doesn't disqualify you from being worthy of getting funding and investment. Like, I'll give you a very specific example. There was a startup on Cherub that was doing $8 million in revenue a year. And this person had bootstrapped their business. So they knew nothing about fundraising and institutional and angel investors and how to even find these people or get started. And so I think that is a testament to the fact that so many people have not just great ideas, but genuinely great, solid businesses. And there's still that lack of access. And then on the investor side, you know, we really thought about the Mies of the world. Ultimately, we were like, could we be Raya for deal flow? Could we connect really great startups and really great angels that they otherwise wouldn't have met and bring them together to get deals done? And from there, we built a really beautiful, robust network. We saw, I think, in our very first like 3 months of testing, we ran 40 companies through the platform. 100% of them got views, pitch deck views they otherwise wouldn't have gotten. 100% of them got investors requesting interest to them. You know, normally it's just a thankless game of cold outreach, being like, please, someone answer me, someone write me back. So the idea that like, 50% of those companies had investors being like, hey, can I talk to that person? That showed us that we were onto something. And then of those companies, 20% secured funding within 3 months. So we knew that we were able to connect people that otherwise wouldn't necessarily meet and get deals done, which was super exciting. What we learned along the way was that really what founders needed the most help with. And so what we have been hard at work on, and, you know, I think as we built this out, you mentioned it's been about a year for our journey, the speed in which AI has improved and become integrated and really a crucial part of every company's workflows has just accelerated beyond what we could have imagined. And so we've spent the past few months really kind of evolving from this Raya for deal flow concept to being the AI native fundraising co-pilot built for both sides of the table. So on the back end, helping you both from the investor side and the founder side be able to know who's the most serious, what does the fit look like. I think As a founder and an investor, one of the things that we often hear on the founder side from founders is it me or ... right? And then on the investor side, it's like, is this good? I don't know. I don't know everything about this industry. It's really hard to understand what an exit looks like. What are traditional benchmarks? And so we're trying to bring transparency to all of these kind of isolated, opaque issues at the forefront of the experience. And so ultimately, what we're doing is helping you log in, simply put your best foot forward from a fundraise perspective if you're a founder. It's just streamlining that process for you so that you know who's serious, who's looking at what, getting you to close faster. And then on the investor side, really, can we give you the personalized one-to-one fit scoring and due diligence that you would need to make a decision faster? So we don't look at it as like, we're going to try to get you to say yes to this company. We actually look at it as like, can we quickly get you to a yes or a no? So really, on both sides, it's confidence and control in this otherwise fragmented, outdated, what we like to call first mile of fundraising.
That is so cool. And I can only imagine any founder that's listening is so grateful and excited for that, because I speak to so many founders, especially in the early stages, that is their biggest problem. And fundraising takes up so much time where they otherwise could be using that to actually build their companies. That said, that there is this kind of chicken or egg where you need to have funding to be able to do so many things, but it also takes time to get it. And the data that you guys actually have access to and being able to personalize it for their industry or the type of company that they're going after or the amount that they're raising for and being able to provide personalized advice would be amazing. So that's super exciting. And what's also just incredible is kind of the traction and growth that you've had over the past year, which is, you know, $5 million in funding. That is a major number that, if not for Cherub to have existed, who knows if that would have actually occurred. And, you know, I'm certainly familiar with the stat that I, you know, love to hate, which is the limited amount of money that typically goes towards women founders. But what I have found to be, you know, so interesting is about 15% of venture investors are women. But yes, of angel investors, it's almost half are women.
Yes,
and so that, and again, that is a really cool element of it, which, you know, certainly one gives a lot of women the access to a ton of deal flow, but also empowers them to use it in a way that is potentially supporting other female founders. So really, really amazing and unique. And it's just fantastic that you guys have built this. So I imagine that there are some listeners that maybe aren't founders yet, but dream about doing it one day. And so I would love to just hear, you know, general founder advice that you may have for them.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that, so I have a toddler. I have a 20-month-old. I think like the type of advice that you hear founders and entrepreneurs give other founders is kind of like what you hear parents tell other parents, in the sense that like basically every cliche you hear is true, that you have to live through those cliches, right? So to me, it's like, just do it is probably the first thing I would say, but maybe just do it with a big asterisk, right? So take the calculated bets and risks that you feel comfortable taking to either validate or invalidate your hypotheses.
I love that advice. And it's totally accurate and very consistent with what I hear, which is, it is everything that I was told, but it feels different actually going.
Yeah.
So you might as well try. So Angelina, I want to end with some rapid fire questions. So quick, instinctive answers. What is the best advice you've received?
The only constant is change. I think about it every day.
What is the first thing you do every morning?
I'm lucky. My husband gives me coffee and it's very silly. The New York Times game.
That's
just
great.
It's my one moment of just like pure indulgence. And this is at 5:30 in the morning. So yeah.
It is an early wake up, but
yes,
it's nice to have coffee. For you, you know, what does living a rich life mean to you?
That's a great question. I think that living a rich life means being unbothered, being able to be at peace with whatever decisions you have made, the risks that you take in, anything that you might have regretted, like just being at peace with things is a rich life.
It's a beautiful answer. What do you wish you knew before starting your own company?
There's a lot of like the non-fun stuff that you'll spend time working on, right? Which is like, for me, I mean, accounting, voice payments, all of those things, I'd say I'd encourage you, if there's a SaaS tool for that, just go ahead and spend that money and do that.
And lastly, what are you dreaming about next?
A real vacation. As I mentioned, having a 20-month-old, it's like you can take her somewhere and it's just parenting in a different location. And my husband and I were like, maybe a few years. We're like, what is that age range? And she's like, 3, 5, I don't know. One day we'll have it again. We've had plenty of those adventures before. We will have them again, but I'm definitely dreaming about that.
That sounds really nice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this conversation. I've loved every minute of it. And I know that I could talk to you so much longer about so many other big ideas. But for those of you who are looking to continue to follow your journey, where can they find you?
So Invest with Cherub is the best kind of handle to see what's going on. But yes, Invest with Cherub, LinkedIn, TikTok, Instagram, all of it.
Well, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Alexis.
I so enjoyed that conversation. You know, for too long, angel investing has felt like an insider's game. You needed to know someone who knew someone. You needed to be in the right room at the right event with the right connections. And if you were a founder, especially a female or BIPOC founder, you were told that the money was out there, but somehow you could never quite reach it. And what Angeline and Jacqueline have built is a bridge. They're not just connecting founders with capital. They're connecting them with strategic partners who bring expertise, networks, and belief. They're bringing first-time angel investors permission to write that first check, and they're making the whole ecosystem more human, intentional, and more about fit than transactions. You can find Cherub at investwithcherub.com and follow Angeline's journey on LinkedIn. As always, if you love this episode, subscribe to Dreaming Big wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. I'm Alexis Allen. Thanks so much for going deep with me today. And remember, keep dreaming big dreams.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.